I know the apology of sin. The Honorable Minister, she was just discharged from hospital yesterday, so she won't be able to attend. In fact, I was thinking that we can pass by and see the minister. She did say she'll be available for us to go and see her for 5 or 10 minutes after this, if it's possible. Maybe we should finish a bit earlier so that we can do that. And then we also have got apology from the Deputy Minister. She's got a meeting in Swan in the morning, and we'll only be arriving in Cape Town in the afternoon. Which other apology do we have, sir?
I have two apologies from the committee members, Honorable Mabilo and Honorable Adam.
Okay, and then we've got the standard apology from one member who's not well. Any further apology? Apologies, none. The DG has indicated she wants to be released earlier. There's some issues that she wants to attend to. So if you, as soon as you are ready, you can just indicate and leave. Any further apologies? None. Oh, no, that's fine. Honorable Makuya?
No, Chair, I wanted to find out at one point EFF was consistent, but I know of other circumstances that have been in terms of promising.
We do have a member from the EFF, so yeah, I think we are ready for you, CEO. So we'll then head over to the TG. The introduction, I think we can only get it from those that did not come before the committee before. But the faces are familiar. I don't know if there's anybody who's come here for the first time ever since this chair is sitting here. Oh, yes. Can we just get the introduction now?
Chair, honourable members, just to introduce our Park Operations Director, who wasn't with me last week. His name is Philip Sibia.
Thank you. From St. Pat's.
Chair, today I'm accompanied by the colleagues here, Mr. Paul Daphne. He is the head of Social Economic Development in St. Pat's. And then I have Elizabeth Mchongo, who is the head of our corporate investment. And then we have Yin Lokele, who is also head of land administration and land banks of St. Pat's.
Okay. Otherwise, everybody, the faces are familiar. We did request in the last meeting, DG, that it's necessary that when we receive reports from the entities, we know that when we inform that the board is not a full-time board, none of the board members are full-time. But we did request that it is if they can, you can make arrangements for the chair to be here when we get briefing from some parts of the chair of the board. Because the board is an authority where the entity reports to, so it's important for us to interact with the board. But I know, I see they have not made provision for that now. CEO. So I'm saying that in the next meeting, if that arrangement could be made. I don't know what would be the impact of the cost, but I'm sure you can see how you limit then the participation of other staff members and then get the chair of the board to be here. So that he or she can also be able to interact with the committee.
Thanks, Chair. It's a matter that we are still going to get the input right to the boards because her arrangement with the board was that we must always appear before Parliament when we discuss the reports, the quarterly reports and the annual report. But for briefings, the understanding was that the executives would then handle that. I can't communicate directly, and the minister said I must be here on that requirement. So we'll process it, Chairperson, for the future. Thanks very much.
No, we'll appreciate very much DG that we interact with the boards. They also got the responsibility, they take certain decisions. And therefore they must also account for those decisions that they are taking to us. Well, the last briefing was the first quarter, they were not here. I agree that the quarterly reports, they can come and the annual report. The normal briefing, unless if we want anything from them, it's not necessary that they can be here. But this quarterly and annual reports, would prefer that they are also here from all the entities, actually. Okay, DG, you can take us through or delegate someone to take us through.
Thanks, Chair. The CEO of Centrax and his team will deal with the Centrax presentation and the acting CEO for Simangaliso West Edge Park Authority will then lead the presentation. So I'm handing over to them as honorable chair. Thanks.
All right, thank you, DG. CEO, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, honorable chair, honorable members, good morning. As petty brief, we are coming here with two presentations. One is about benefit sharing in the vitality assets with communities. The second report presentation will be on land claims beneficiation model of Centrax. So for one, we will share this presentation on members amongst ourselves. On this one of the benefit sharing on the part of the assets, I must say, honorable members, the timing is so good to request us to come and do this briefing, because even globally, a discourse is underway around nature's benefits to people, and it's talking more to broader environmental aspects, how people benefit in terms of their well-being, in terms of good quality of life, because these assets are providing regulating water quality, air quality, all of those is because of the Mother Nature. Therefore, we hear more of discussions around nature's benefits to people. But for today, our understanding is that we come and brief the committee on tangible ones. We leave the air and water for now. We'll talk to the tangibles. The content of our presentation will touch briefly on socio-economic development in Centrax, because we had to form a division in order for us to integrate and drive issues of socio-economic development. We'll talk about the wildlife economy programs, other resource use and retail programs. I'll talk about our corporate social investment, what we do there. Resolution of land claims, we'll touch on only one slide here just to give the context, but our second presentation will be fully looking at this. Blue economy, how do we handle contract support arrangements with stakeholders, our PPP model, how are we approaching that, and also those programs are funded by government for Sandbox to implement, like the expanded public works program on the policy committee, jobs being created there. Of course, we'll talk briefly on challenges, those are always there, and the potential for us to move forward. Next slide. This whole issue of community sharing in public assets of national parks, it must be understood in context of a strategic approach to socio-economic development. It is indeed defined as one of the core pillars of Sandbox, along with conservation and tourism. Because all the time emphasis has been to conservation and tourism. But integrating other issues around socio-economic development is key for us to our organization to move forward. We know our parks have a key role to play as drivers of local economic development. And we have put a number of programs in place to ensure that maximize these benefits to the surrounding communities. However, there's still a challenge because of the history of our country. Neighboring communities not always appreciating what comes out of the national park system. Therefore, that element of awareness is key, even element of capacity building. In the wildlife economy project, next slide. In 2015, we pledged during the border economy in Durban in Durban that we will indeed donate 500 head of game worth more than 10 million over the next 3 years to communities adjacent to our national parks. When I say adjacent, we need to be able to do support both delivery of animals. Although at times we get requests from everywhere, where we are very far, but we're trying to say, as per our criteria, we'd like to deal with the neighboring communities to our national parks because there are still other provincial authorities who are running provincial parks who can take care of that part. Hence, there was that part of the economy in Durban. That's why we pledged the sellers. We've already delivered the two batches of the zebra to the common Islam community because they are so organized. So we delivered the first batch. They have infrastructure. We've assessed the stability of the habitat and the viability of the habitat. They have infrastructure. They are also working with the game ranchers and PPF to support the management of their wildlife in their area. Therefore, it's clear that there's long-term sustainability. There's commitment to them. Hence, we deliver the second batch. We have developed what you call donation/custodianship policy. Because in whatever we do, we need to develop a criteria. You will donate under what circumstances? Therefore, there's a checklist of saying if you apply to be given game, you must meet certain criteria because we don't want to go back 10 years down the line, the animals are gone. Therefore, it will be really, really a waste of time. Therefore, we need to look at sort of capacity and this sort of level of ability and also willingness and readiness of different stakeholders to accept the game. We will again soon be delivering to Massimal CPA, which is adjacent to Kruger National Park, to support the Marakapula Lodge that is operating well. We are also doing feasibility studies, because now as you start getting all these requests, you need to go and check, can it work? Because you don't want to come and go and deliver, and then tomorrow there are no animals. Therefore, we're conducting in certain properties, Bezula and Gijana, still neighboring Kruger National Park, the reinforced mark in the Northern Cape, adjacent to our Ohrades National Park, and in on Beersheba, which is adjacent to the Arua Elephant National Park. Because they've been requesting, therefore we're busy doing feasibility to check if they are ready to receive the wildlife. Next slide. This is one delivery of this particular animal in Northern Cape. You can see it's healthy, although he stayed in a boma for a while. But you can see it's relaxed because they need to adapt when move from one place to the next place. Next slide.
Just
Thank you, sir, for protecting me from the honorable member.
We are just showing this map, that committee, that yellow dot at the bottom, they are labeling one of the national parks. Next slide. The issue of game building is a bit polarized in our country. Is game breeding going to go? We feel that there are areas where it cannot. We as state parks, we don't breed animals. We believe in open systems national parks where animals will survive naturally. But we are willing to support programs because it will depend on the size of the land. The issue of hunting, we don't hunt in our national parks, but we are willing to support hunting because of the economic activity. But we know that wildlife-based ecotourism is the way to go. But we know that if you get investments, if you go hunting, you do get quick returns. But ecotourism creates a lot of jobs. In hunting, you make a lot of money. Therefore, we need the balancing act there on what to do. The way we contribute to hunting, as I indicated, don't hunt in national parks. But then it's issued by provincial authorities. There are parks where fences have been dropped, like with the Maguia and Mekaba, Botan and Kruger. The animals, they move from Kruger to those areas, and then hunting goes ahead. They were like a breeding ground to support the whole hunting operations. We also emphasize in ecotourism, especially the last land that was referring to our lodge in the Transfrontier Park. The red, this is not of Kruger. At the top, you see the red area is Makuleke land, which is within the Kruger Park. That was settled long time ago. They do hunting that area. But we heard of new developments now that day. With the shareholders, they want to put more emphasis in the ecotourism. They are thinking of stopping hunting. But again, we are leaving to them and their shareholders. You can see the other green is your Makuya, just below that. You go to the Tower Ranch, you also go to Manyeleti. All those activities are happening adjacent to our national park. Next slide. We have also started the process of looking at imaging game farmers. Because what we've picked up, there's a lot of emerging entrepreneurs. They do have the capital, but they will always invest in mining and agriculture and other stuff. But we are saying there's still a game changer called wildlife economy. Perhaps we can start investing on those. We had a workshop in February whereby we were saying, as an parks, we are a public entity, we have the mandate. This is how far we can go in terms of working with them. That's one. Secondly, we were also creating awareness because not every black entrepreneur appreciates animals. So this thing, you kill it and eat it, that's it. Where is money, this thing? Therefore, we have to create that awareness so that they understand how it works. Therefore, we're saying, we have seen millionaires in South Africa who happen to be white. They're investing in this thing because due to climate change, due to drought issues, wildlife is more resilient to climate change. You don't have to deep these animals. You don't have to inoculate them. Therefore, during dry season, they can still survive. Therefore, there's that type of awareness we're creating. Even when we did an auction recently in the Adjoele Financial Park, we invited them. They came to see, but we were surprised to see some beating, dying animals. Seeing they have game farms already. Therefore, we're not saying this thing to achieve equity, there must be an element of them understanding the regulatory regime and also understanding what it means to keep wildlife in a property. Cattle dealership schemes are being developed whereby we want to loan these animals because once we call it a donation, put together to fellow. We want our animals back once they've established a new some stock for themselves. The drought situation, of course, it leads to culling of animals. Culling is not killing. It's a management tool. If there are too many, because we have fences, we must drop the numbers in order not to impact on your ecosystem and on your vegetation, not impact negatively in water, not impact negatively in the whole landscape. Therefore, this of Karen is informed by sensors that you do have to say there are too many animals now. Instead of seeing them dying because of cloud, you do what you call culling. And then there are programs being initiated which we need now to refine them. Because when you talk of culling in Kruger, it's a challenge. Kruger is full of disease. There's a line that you cannot take even a meeting to committee before a particular line. But the veterinarians of agriculture are guiding on that. Therefore, it's difficult to even say, can you establish apparatus is around Kruger because of that agreed line. It's one thing that we are working with agriculture to try and look at it. Next slide. I will hand over to Elizabeth to do other resource use and related programs. Thank you.
Thank you, Fidi and honorable members. The program I'll be presenting on is on the resource use, which basically allows communities that are in the national park to have access to floral resources in the park, especially those resources where are not in abundance in the community, which communities would need for sustainability. The first one, we have the search grass harvesting in Kruger National Park and Golden Gate, where communities are allowed to access where there is grass for searching. They are allowed to have access into the park to harvest it. At the Balas National Park, the communities that would like to use reef for harvesting, for searching, they are allowed to have access to that. And also in Galas National Park, there's a sour fig where the communities are allowed to harvest it. The intention with this one is to assist them at a later stage to generate some economic activities out of in terms of processing and all that. And at the Garden Route National Park, there's also firewood that communities are allowed to harvest for, you know, use in their own homestead, and they are also allowed to sell it. And in Kruger, there's a paperback project, which is basically herbalism. This is primarily used by our traditional health practitioner, and it's not found, or it is not in abundance outside the national park. So now the communities have requested for access to live inside the park, but what we are even doing there is to assist them to propagate it outside. There are nurseries that are being established because, as I said, it is one of those resources that are not in abundance, and when you look at the traditional healers, they really use it for a lot of the activities that are involved in. So now we then have assisted, and there's one in the around the Maguia area, which is outside in the north of Kruger National Park, where we have established a nursery there, where the traditional practitioners are propagating the Webagia. And the famous wild ginger and African potato, our traditional health practitioners are assisted to harvest, but at the same time to propagate it in the nursery. And with regard to Mabaniwem, when the Mabaniwem is available in the Kruger National Park, they are also allowed to harvest. And with this one, at times there are groups that will be allowed to come in. It's not everybody. But then what they do, when they go out, they sell some of these things to their own community because they of the limited number of people that come to the park, but then also at times they able to share it among themselves. And this one also needs a way of controlling when people come into the park because it needs security and all that for them to be able to really access. But we are making this available. And it doesn't have like now, for the past year we did not have Mabaniwem, so they didn't have access. But as and when Mabaniwem is available, we do allow them to have access to have it. Also, in terms of our school programs, our environmental education programs, we do provide indigenous trees to schools to grow. We have our environmental education officers that are involved in schools, and one of the programs that they do is basically assisting schools in planting the indigenous trees. Next slide, please. And I've also spoken to the nurseries, where we are establishing medicinal nurseries in schools. in communities rather to support for the propagation of and sustainable use of the medicinal and related plants. This one that you see is happening in the Garden Route, where we have the Judah Square Rastafarian community. Basically, there's a rose water plant that is being propagated there, which is used by the Judah community, Rastafarian community. And this plant was found in the park, but we are now assisting them to, or actually they have already started to venerate outside the park, where they are propagating the plant in order for it to continue being there and being sustained. Next slide. And the other thing that we're also doing is to support the establishment of the gardens for food security and enterprise development. Because we believe that as a park we can be the first level of consuming some of the vegetables that are coming from the communities, and it's all we believe as part of the enterprise development in communities as well as food security that we need to get involved there. In the Karoo National Park, there are vegetables that have been planted there. You can see your spinach, beetroot, and all that. But what is important is that some of these vegetables are now supplying our park restaurants, and communities are able also to go to the local market. And in Putrichama, the same. In Golden Gate, outside Golden Gate, we have supported the establishment of the vegetable garden, and the communities are able to sell to us and even to the spa in the area. This is just an indication of the vegetable garden that we have in Karoo. Then the next slide, please. This one would be Putrichama vegetable garden. As you can see, the type of vegetables that communities are able to grow. And the other one is on the Asen Coast. This one is where we are encouraging communities and actually facilitating them to have access to our markets as national parks, because of the unique aspects that they do in the area. The aim here is to really ensure that they're able to access the markets that visit our national parks. Now, in Kruger National Park, there are a few of these established at the entrance gates, where communities are able to sell their art and craft to them. There are art and craft outlets established, as you can see, and saying they are feeding permanent staff members employed from the community employed, and who then are able to collect the crafts from the other crafters in the community and are able to sell them at the gate. And last year, for instance, they were able to make 2.7 million. These are generated from the collective artwork that they presented and sold. And this is one of our outlets, sales outlets created at Palabora Gate. And then the other program is around projects, is around your car wash program, where we have established three of these in our camps, in Skukuza, Sagara, and Letaba. Basically, the community allowed access to the car wash inside the park, and where the tourists cars are being access to them to wash. But also, as one part, we have, like in Skukuza, we are also providing them with the opportunity to wash some of the cars that belong to the organization as well. This is very of just increasing the income there. And there's a bee farming initiative at Garden Route, where we have assisted the community to set up this. And at the moment, the equipment was provided, and the project is running well, to the point that some of the bee farmers have connected with the NYSNA bee farming activity in the area, and they're able to sell the honey bee. The next slide. Okay, so I think this is where I'll go, and I'll hand over to the CEO. Thank you.
Members, I'll do, just to run it through a bit quicker, I will do corporate social investment. We are currently taking 1% of our accommodation and other income. We allocate to this CSI program, which comes to about 6 million per year. For the last year, we focused more on computer labs, because some schools, they do physical science, but they don't have a laboratory for experimentation. Therefore, you can see the list that I've actually did last year. Next slide. The, for this year, we want to, we've already identified some schools that are listed there. They happen to be in Limpopo and Mpumalanga. And then we also want to donate an e-learning facility to schools in the Akam area near Galahadi. We are also proposing to the board that we want to take 5% of our income generated from rhino sales or wildlife sales, hybrid species, rhino and buffalo, to allocate this program. But that probably is still going to be approved by the board. But as an extra, that's what we are proposing, is it? Land claims, there would be a parallel presentation on this. Just to say, you might have seen the Kokawan, whereby a phase one was done because there was a cabinet decision not to restore the title to be compensated. It's part of the Restitution Act, but we'll do a parallel presentation out of this one. Next slide. I'll hand over to Paul. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. Chair, if we look briefly at just one slide on the blue economy as opposed to the green economy, members may be aware that there is a process underway to engage with the public with a view to rezoning of the marine protected area adjacent to the Tsikama section of the Garden Route National Park. And the objective of that rezoning is to put in place a number of zones where limited and controlled fishing by community, defined community members, can take place. This process is still in motion. It has generated a lot of public debate. But we as St. Parks are supportive of the process, which has been driven by our department, and are supportive of the process not just because those communities do have a historic right to fishing in that area, but we believe that our ability to achieve our marine conservation objectives will be better served by working with the community as partners rather than constantly being in opposition to the community. Next slide. Chair, contractual park agreements, where they exist, and they generally are to be found where there has been successful land care, provide a context within which, a structured context within which to provide benefits to communities. In Sand Parks, we have three community contractual park agreements in place. One is the Makuleke in Kruger. The other is with the San and Mir communities at Galahadi, and the other is in the Richtersveld. And I should note that the Richtersveld contract park agreement is not the result of a land claim. The Richtersvelders did have a land claim, but that was outside of the park, which has been dealt with. It has been successful. But this was an agreement between the Richtersvelders and the government in the 1990s that the land would be set aside for conservation and there would be certain benefits accruing to communities. A new contract park agreement that we are wishing to put in place is with the Rim Pasmark community, which is next door to the Bahrain's Falls National Park. And we have had a meeting with the Rim Pasmark Trust with a view to putting that in motion. We haven't achieved as much progress as we would have liked in respect of this particular community, and there are reasons for that, but there is the potential for wildlife economy development on the land, which has been successfully claimed by the community in park, which is the Melkbos Run property. And then, Chair, I want to say a few words about the Maiwe and Glory Development Trust, which is another framework of agreement between a park and the community, which provides for benefit sharing, although it's not a contract park arrangement. That is a picture of the Rimfasmark Trust. They sent a delegation of 10 people to come to our head office. This is a picture of the Erfia Biakar, which is the Richtersveld Joint Management Committee. And it's a very interesting structure, and this contract has been in place for 25 years now, where each village in the Richtersveld area, and there are four villages, each village has a representative to this committee. And the goat farmers, who are allowed both on a cultural and sustainable resource use basis to continue goat farming in the park, also have a representative to this committee. The committee is elected at regular intervals under the auspices of the IEC, and it has given us a model, in a sense, of how one can maintain a structured relationship with the community despite disagreements, despite problems over a length of time. Just to say some words about the Maivuya Lawview Development Trust, which is a trust established around the Addo Elephant National Park. In fact, our CEO, when he was a young park manager there, about 15 years ago, I guess, initiated this trust. And it has provided us with a model of ideally how to engage with communities. The trust was formally registered in 2005. It had the objectives of improving quality of life of the beneficiaries and to address poverty, unemployment, socioeconomic needs. Let's have the next slide. There's just a representation of the park and some of the communities around the park. The Addo Elephant National Park is a massive park stretching from the marine protected area on the coast right up into the Karoo in the Darlington area. Most people just know it at Main Camp, where it was first established, east to Colchester. If we go to the next slide, we have a, I should just mention that on the Maivui and Lawview Trust, we have two representatives from each community around the park, and there are also representatives from Sand Park, two representatives. And that trust has functioned effectively, relatively well over the past 10 years or so. There's a revenue sharing agreement with the Mitchell Rennie Rest Camp, where the community, through the trust, are getting 6 to 12% share of income for that rest camp. The percentage becoming greater when the occupancies are higher, and it's in the capacity of the park to be able to pay more. Through that income, the trust then employs a project manager, and this is all relevant to our discussions on the resolution of the Kruger Land claim, and that project manager then runs a program of bursaries, assisting schools with scholar transport, SMME support, hop-on guides who are tourist guides, and also we are now discussing with the community construction of a new 10-unit lodge, with a 50% profit sharing between ourselves and the trust. Next slide. So just moving briefly to public-private partnerships, and this is an important area of community empowerment because we have over 40 lodges, restaurants, shops and other concessions, largely in the Kruger Park but also in other parks, which provide an opportunity for communities to become involved in high-level tourism business. And there's a new provision where a minimum of 10% of equity, and that needs to be free equity, when bidders are bidding during a bidding process, there has to be a minimum of free 10% equity to go to communities. The multiplier effects of these lodges are great. I've indicated up there are 1,946 permanent jobs created. An upmarket lodge creates at least one job per bed in that lodge, which is a much higher ratio than we would have in our rest camps because it's a fully catered experience. So they are great in terms of job creation, and there's a local SMME spend of more than 57 million. There are other benefits because we work together with our concessionaires to ensure that they themselves are doing community outreach programs. And there are a number of programs in place, chef school, soap making operation, taxi services being supported by the concessions. And we've developed a model at Pictor sites which build land payments into equity in a concessionaire at that Pictor site. Moving to the expanded public works program, just very briefly, Sand Parks is the biggest single implementer of government's expanded public works program. With an annual budget of $434 million, we started about 12 years ago with a budget of about $30 million. So this has grown exponentially, and government has been supporting this program to a great extent. Jobs are created for neighboring communities to national parks, and there are also biodiversity outputs. We do alien clearing, wetland rehabilitation, coastal cleanup. The Environmental Monitors Program is a program within EPWP which provides support in anti-poaching activities. There are the eco-furniture programs which make furniture from invasive trees. It's all done on the basis of labor-intensive construction and and methods. Let's go to the next slide quite quickly. The total number of people who will be employed, if we can just go back, in this year that we are in, are 7,600, which is greater than our own permanent staff complement. The number of communities that they will be drawn from around all the national parks in the country is 359 communities. Next slide. If one equates that figure of 7,600 to full-time equivalents, which is merely dividing the number of person days worked by a working year, which is 235 days, you get a full-time equivalent, and this is our target that we have been achieving this over the past years, of over 6,000 full-time equivalents of employment in these programs. I think it's important to note that we report a measure in terms of the percentage women and the percentage youth. And in these programs, we have a 70% youth intake, and we have 55% of women. There's a strong SMME support program, contractors for alien clearing, and a number of other types of SMMEs. In this year, we are employing and appointing 440 SMMEs, and the total amount to be paid for those SMMEs will be 167 million. And also, there's a connection to social events in the communities where the work teams would do cleanups on Mandela Day. They would adopt a school in terms of assisting with infrastructure and so on at schools. Training is an important part of this program. We train both the work teams who are involved in field work as well as the SMMEs, where the SMMEs get a fairly broad training on business skills, accounting, etc., with the view that we are really committed to empowering them beyond the particular line of contracting that they'll be at that point in time. Chair, this is an important table. This is really the minister's table, because when she gives a speech in the national park, she would normally end by saying, this morning over 13,000 people got up and went to work in a national park. And that is the case today. If we look at the permanent Sand Park staff members, there's over 4,000 contracts and temps, just under 1,000 expanded public works, and we're measuring the full-time equivalents, 6,250, and then the jobs that are created in the concessions, which will bring you to a total of more than 30,000 people who went to work in a national park this morning. Chair, some of the challenges. I have spoken briefly now and again about the challenges. I think we do recognize, and the CEO made reference to it, that the history of dispossession and exclusion means there is still a trust deficit which has to be made up in order to develop these relationships. And we have many programs which are not necessarily economic development focused, such as environmental education programs, where more than 200,000 people from neighboring communities come through the park every year on environmental education programs. South African National Parks Week, which will be happening soon, second week of September, where free access is given and proactive steps are taken to actually transport people into the parks, people who hitherto have not visited the parks, where more than 50,000 people will access the parks for free. I think one of the challenges we face, and it's not specific to our programs, is that management capacity is often lacking within communities in respect to the implementation of development programs. We have a well-structured operation. The CEO referred to the Komani San game ranching operation. There's a partnership with the Peace Parks Foundation and Wildlife Ranching South Africa, also providing mentoring in that program to ensure its success. There are other examples of partnerships between communities and private operators which are not that successful. We do find sometimes, unless the community has legal assistance and other assistance when entering into those projects, private individuals, private companies can take advantage of communities in the way relationships are structured. Appropriate institutional arrangements are not always in place. We rarely, where it's a land claim, we need a functioning CPA or a trust, such as the Maibuye Norbu Trust, or a well-functioning traditional authority in order to ensure the flow of benefits to communities. And these are some of the criteria really that we put in place in terms of providing assistance to communities. We must have some assurance that there are structures both for management and structures that would ensure there is a flow of benefit to communities. I'm just mentioning there that EAR has provided us with 10 million rand for the Bubula Gijana and the Nkambeni projects next to the Kruger National Park, where we are going to do a wildlife economy program. And also the infrastructure development program funding of 16 million each for the Lendlovu Lodge in Addo and the Our Lodge in the Khalkhari Transfrontier Park. There is a potential for further community benefit sharing, and I mentioned some of these. The CEO did indicate that feasibility studies are being conducted in a range of environments. We are doing a feasibility study at Limpasmark, we're doing a feasibility study at Iran Beshiba next to Addo, and we're doing a number of feasibility studies around the Kruger National Park. In order to make sure that our interventions are appropriate, as the CEO said, we don't just want to drop animals, take it off, and then walk away. We want a long-term relationship, and we want benefits to be sustainable to communities. We are looking at developing activity hubs at Palabora Gate and Shamboni Gate, adjacent to the Kruger National Park. We have 25 million rand for each of those projects from the Department of Tourism. This is really to develop some base infrastructure, which will stimulate business just outside the gate at those two areas of the park. And Chair, there is a potential to bring communities further into the ecotourism sector through equity and concessions, as I was mentioning earlier. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chair. Closing comments, CEO.
Chair, thank you for the opportunity once again. I'm not sure if you want us to do the labeling right away, for the second presentation of the first test, or we want to read later, I'm not sure, we need your guidance.
I thought your presentation was bad. How much time do you need to do that? How much time?
5 minutes.
Okay, let's give you 10 minutes then.
Okay, thank you. My presentation is on land claims, and I will give an overview of how many land claims we've got in national parks and the different settlement models that we've implemented or that we're intending to implement. Next slide. So far, we've got 11 land claims in 11 national parks. These are land claims that were submitted before the cut-off date of 1998, so these are not new land claims, they are old land claims. And just a reminder that the resolution of land claims is the mandate of the Commission on Restitution of Land Rights. So SANPARKS involvement is mostly on the research stages and the stakeholder engagement, all the negotiations, that is in identifying beneficiation for claimants. We've settled 3 land claims so far, and 5 of those, we've settled phase 1 land claims, we have 5, and we still have 8 outstanding land claims, including phase 2. On the phase 1, Namapa National Park, they were given financial compensation, Golden Gate, the Kruger, and the Gama is also financial compensation. So phase 1 is normally easy where claimants opt for financial compensation. The other is where the claimants opted for alternative land. The Golden Gate land claim, which was settled last year, they were given 29 million, it was 79 families. Next slide. That's the Kruger land claim, phase 1, which was settled this year in May, where the president handed over a check of 84 million to 6 communities. Looking at the restoration models, this is models where we've given land to communities, or we combined land plus financial compensation. The Restitution Act allows for restoration of the claimed land, or financial compensation, or alternative land. So we mix those three in most of these models. Just to give you guiding principles, when we settle land claims in national park, we look at the specific parks because parks are different, and because we are national, one park would differ from the other. And we also look at the memorandum of understanding that was signed between the Department of Environmental Affairs and the Department of Land Affairs and Rural Development, that it provides principles for the settlement of land claims in protected areas. And recently, we are also looking at a developmental approach to the settlement of land claims, giving an example of Kruger National Park. So far, there has been 106,000 hectares restored inside national parks. The biggest one has been the Khalakhadi, which is the Kwanisen and the Mir community, where they were given 57,000 hectares. The file was where we did not claim the whole park and we handed it over to the communities, and the park established a new park in Mugala. The Ofradi's one is the Rinsat Mark community, where they were given 4,500 hectares. That claim was put in with the old, remember before the Restitution Act, we had the ACLA, which was the allocation of land commission, where people were able to claim the state land that they had. So we have a list with them. We are negotiating with them to have a contractual park, but because of the infighting within the community, we are still happy with the lease agreement. The settlement models that we've looked at, we have the financial and beneficiation model, which is the one that we'll be implementing in Kruger National Park. We have the restoration and development model. That one we have done in Kruger with the Makuleke and also in Khalakhadi with the Komanisen. We have the financial land and land, the financial compensation and land swap, which we're implementing in Namakwa National Park. The complete restoration, that's the one I was talking about, the firewalls one. And then we have alternative land swap and beneficiation. That's one of our most complicated models, but we are aiming to settle it successfully. Starting with the complete restoration, that's where we proclaimed the whole park, the Far Board National Park, and we give the land to the community. It is the Commission Board sent us Mukala National Park as a replacement of that national park. Just to give a word of warning, this is a very rare settlement model. I don't think we'll be repeating it anytime soon because it requires a lot of land to replace what we have lost as an impact. The restoration and development model. This is the Khalakhadi. I thought it was a nice picture to add in. They look so happy. That's where the Komanisen and the Mir community has claimed. That's their land now, which is inside Khalakhadi National Park. And this one, we signed an agreement, a 99-year trilateral agreement with the, we call it the IHI, excuse my pronunciation of the Komanisen language, we call it the IHI Kalahari Heritage Agreement. It took effect in 2002 to establish the contractual park. It is managed by the Joint Management Board. I think my colleague alluded to that. In this agreement, we implemented the Komanisen resource use cultural rights, where they practice their rights inside the park, their cultural rights inside the park. We have a three-way revenue sharing agreement for the house lodge. And then we have a future socio-economic benefit where we'll be building or developing an outlop where it will be a 50-50% profit sharing agreement. SANParks has also donated game to the Komanisen. In the Khalakhadi, SANParks is responsible for the daily conservation of the area. Going to the next model, which is the restoration and development model. Still on the Komanisen. The challenge that we have realized on the Komanisen and Mir land claim is that there is no capacity within the claimant community to manage the projects, especially the law, the development projects. And we've recently, because of the different culture between the Komanisen and your normal community, it was difficult to reach a resource use agreement with them. I'll just give an example. For the Komanisen, hunting is a cultural thing, and for us as SANParks, we do not allow hunting inside national parks. So it was one of those things But the success is we've come to an agreement in principle on the cultural resources. The Makuleke, this is also one of our oldest land claims. It's the cheap one at the top of Kruger. I think that the CEO had a slide on that. Next slide. That's the Makuleke contractual part. And Mr. Lamson is the park manager now at the contractual park. He's one of the communities who's now the park manager. The land was restored in 1999 and we have a 50-year contract with them. It is also managed by the MD between Sefax and the Makuleke. There are three concessions on the Makuleke land that the concessionaire signed with the Makuleke CPA. With the money that the Makuleke received from the concessions, they were able to do agricultural products, they built schools, and they're also doing ecotourism at the Makuleke village, which is next to the contractual park. The challenges was one of the big challenges is achieving a balance between conservation and development issues, because the agreement that is signed between the concession and Makuleke is just between the same parties, is not enough. So we are unable to advise them on the agreements. And I thought it's important to highlight the threat as well, that the Makuleke can withdraw their land from the national park with just a 5 years notice. And then going to the next slide, the Golden Gate. Like I said, this is one of our most difficult or complicated models yet. The blue is the land that we are proposing that we de-proclaim and give to the claimants so that they can practice their livestock, because they've got livestock. And we've done a presentation to the Sandparks Board. They have approved in principle that we deposit that blue part. The model involves that we do alternative land and we swap lands with them and also come up with a beneficiation model. The claimants will continue livestock grazing on the blue part that I've highlighted. And the proposal also includes the purchase of additional land whereby Sandparks will then donate wildlife to the claimants. The financial and beneficiation model, that's the phase two of the Kruger land claims. Cabinet made a decision that the Kruger land claimants will not receive their land, and that was a 2008 decision. The phase one is the $84 million that they will pay per household. The phase two is the beneficiation package. Senate is still busy with the beneficiation package, but the board has approved it in principle. We just need to then consult with the claimants and see they are happy with the beneficiation package. Next slide, please. We are suggesting that 1% of the tourism income is allocated to a central claimant fund. That is in addition to the other 1% that the CEO was talking about. In addition, 10% of the profits of the forthcoming Fukuza Safari Lodge will also be added to the claimant fund. And also the 5% of the high-value species to be added to the claimant fund. The Kruger model is that we have one claimant fund for all land claims within Kruger, not just the six that were settled, because we have also nine that are remaining, so it will be a beneficiation package for all 15 land claims inside Kruger. In conclusion, there is a potential to expand the beneficiary models to other land claims, but depending on where they have claims or the national park that they have claims. Sandparks is also engaging with the Rimba Smart Trust with a view to develop a wildlife economy initiative on Melkbos Ranch. Melkbos Ranch is just right inside the Akhravis National Park, which is difficult to then establish a wildlife economy, but we are giving ourselves a challenge to do that. And the last bullet in conclusion is that all the land claims or the future land claims, we are going to give them a developmental approach which will be followed wherever possible in resolving land claims in conjunction with DEA and the Land Claims Commission. Thank you. I'd like to be perfect.
Yeah, you wanted 5, I gave you 10, but you exceeded 10. So, yeah, sometimes when you work with the things and you start speaking to them, you elaborate. That is fine, it's information to the community. So we're done, CEO.
Yes, you are the same thing. Just to fetch it's a dynamic process. We're learning from it. We need other partners because it's not easy to do as national parks. This is an opportunity. At the same time, if we don't handle it well, it's a risk for the national park system because you need good neighbors in order to sustain this part of the future. One thing we're busy assessing to share with the risk and audit committee is the impact of these initiatives to our bottom line because we're managing a tight budget, but at the same time I'm aware that there's an element of goodwill here, there's an element of public goods, and also there's an element of private goods. Therefore, we need to balance the act moving forward. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, that's the presentation. We have got an option to take a second mark and discuss all of them at once. Or we can go with this one. It's now 10:11. I would like us to be done by 12:30. So can we invite the second one or do I want to engage with this one? Let's invite the second one. We'll take notes, honorable members, like we did in the past. Let's get the human condition to then give us the presentation. Okay.
I'm going to try and make up some of the time.
Introduce yourself again.
I'm Terry Kestis, acting CEO of the Simangaliso Wetland Park. Good morning, Honourable Chair members. I'm going to deal with the presentation slightly more integrated than my colleagues just to make up the time. If we look at the land claim settlement model in Simangaliso, for a start we've got 14 land claims. 3 have been settled. They were settled between 1998 and 2002. The first one, the Benghazi claim, is the only claim that's settled on a different basis. The Benghazis don't have title to their land, but they have made application to RLCC to be able to get title, and we are supporting that process. The ones in blue were settled in 2007, and we're still sitting with 5 unsettled claims. There's some complexities around them and sort of some delays on the part of the RLCC. So, for example, on the Western Shores, we're still struggling with the verification process. In the northern sections of the park, it's a little bit more complicated in the Coastal Forest Reserve because people still live there, and there is a tension between people who were there forcibly removed, or not successfully forcibly removed, and people who were expected to move. So there's a tension between communities themselves on the ground. The way the process works is DLR, as we call them in Simangaliso, settle claims using a 42D settlement agreement. The agreement is based on title, but no beneficial occupation and conservation in perpetuity. So people have title to it, but they cannot occupy the land and it's used for conservation purposes managed by the state agency. The agreement itself makes provision for co-management agreement, which is also consistent with Section 42 of the Protect Areas Act. We've signed 8 co-management agreements. We've adopted the approach that we can't wait for the RLCC to settle everything. So we sign co-management agreements even in areas where the RLCC has not yet been able to conclude a 42B agreement. Looking at the co-management sort of framework and principles loosely, there's a conservation component, a livelihood and economic development opportunities component, and it sets out roles and responsibilities both for the authority, which are largely around accountability in terms of the government mandate and delivery of their mandate, as well as the responsibilities of the Land Claims Trust, which relate to both to conservation, to tourism development, and to corporate governance. In our case, we don't have local boards. What we have is claimants representation and traditional authority representation on our full board. So if we look at kind of the responsibilities, what we're moving from a rights-based sort of model to a responsibilities-based model. So we're saying we both have a responsibility, both claimants and Isimangaliso, to conserve and protect the asset that gives rise to benefits for future generations and present generations. So if we look at the ownership structure and the system structure, we talk about asset ownership on two dimensions, natural resource use and access, and we talk about it on the basis of revenue share, which is from all our commercial revenue. So claims get 8% of our commercial revenue, whether it's gate revenue, concession fees, game sales, and so on, and they are equity partners in large developments. So we've make it mandatory and compulsory for any private partner to take on an equity partner in the form of the Land Claims Trust, in whose favour that parcel of land has been settled. We've worked at between 10% and 20% as a minimum requirement to try to make this happen. We signed agreements with the Development Finance Institution, IDC, DDSA, and so on, to try to bring cost funding into the process. It's had limited success, and I'll show you what our success record or track record is. It's had limited success, so we're looking now at generating our own finance in the form of grants that we can put in for free to secure the equity contribution of the claimant partner. In terms of smaller activities, tourism activities, game drives, boat cruises, and so on, what we've done is we actually classify or limit certain opportunities to for community ownership. So if you're not 100% community owned, you can actually kind of participate in that opportunity. So for example, if we're giving out 3 game drives or 5 game drives, half of these will be reserved for community owned operations and the other half are open to anybody who wishes to participate in the opportunity. In terms of delivery on this, our revenue sharing at the moment sits at around 1.6, 1.7 million rand a year. Where there are areas where the commercial revenue is not significant, we make an ex gratia payment irrespective. And we do have what we call a community conservation levy that we collect at the gates. It's 5 rand or 6 rand at the moment per visitor. And that money is used to augment revenue sharing, but it also goes into a lot of our other community development programs. In terms of equity partnerships, we have Tonga Beach Lodge, which sits now at 68%, Rocktail Bay Beach Camp, which sits at 17.5%, and Abidi Campsite, which is sitting at 51% community owned. We have another facility coming on in Rocktail Bay shortly, which will also be sitting at around 17.5%. And we're working on 2 more lodges, one at, on the eastern shores of the Bangazi Trust and one on the western shores. And we are conceptualizing some in Mbuzi in the Coastal Forest Reserve. Tourism activity concessions. We're very proud to boast that we had the first ever community-owned fishing charter operation in the country. We have turtle concessions, we have game drive concessions, and we have estuary cruise concessions that are all local community owned. That has been a long process, and we started it about 5 years ago with the enterprise program so that we could develop and invest, develop the skills that people would need to be able to take on the opportunities. Moving on to access. Access is about natural resources. It's also about spiritual and traditional recreational use. We have, for example, in certain areas of the park, burial sites. So people are entitled to come in and perform the celebrations and the customs that are needed on an annual basis. We have an environmental education program where we work with all our children to come to the park. Last year, I think we had about 7,000 children participating in this program. And then we have certain high days and holidays where there's free access. So, for example, New Year's Day is a free access day, and we have about 20,000 people who come and recreate on the beaches. In terms of natural resources, 82% of the coast is open to subsistence fishers. We also harvest nama and various other materials in the park, and there's seasons for doing all of this, and particular limits so that the resource can keep regenerating and be available on a continuous and a regular basis. Moving on to secondary enterprise, which is what we talk about in terms of jobs and training and skills development, we have a rural enterprise program, an arts and crafts program, tourism skills programs. In terms of a Landcare contract, Landcare is a significant employer and it is all community operated. In terms of our maintenance and infrastructure contracts, we impose an obligation on our service providers to create a certain number of jobs, use a certain number of SMEs during the construction and operational phases. And in the tourism development projects, we have the same obligations. We're finding it necessary in current space to start to innovate further because we feel we should be going further. We're starting to look at joint venture arrangements in our infrastructure, and we're starting to look at unbundling a lot of our contracts and operating and contracting on a slightly different basis so that we can increase the scope of the opportunities. What I haven't said is that every year we negotiate an action plan with our tenants around all of this, and we agree effective deliverables so that we can deliver the ability on these benefits. We have 20 craft groups that we work with. We have 50 artists in the program. And we support 185 small businesses. And those small businesses are in everything from spaza shops to, I can't think of the word, but to breeding and selling chickens and goats to tourism enterprises. And we also give grants. So we've paid out 6.9 million in capital for these enterprises to operate. We support about 1,319 jobs in operations, so it's fence maintenance, it's facility management, it's all of those sorts of things. Because our policy and principle is to keep a professional core and subcontract as any of the opportunities and functions that we have in the organization. Expanded public works jobs, if we average them out, they sit at around R3,500 per annum. And then we do a number of sort of capacity building programs which are vocationally based, so it's on the job training. Looking at governance, I've mentioned that local communities in the form of the Provisional Council and Land Claimants sit on our board, and we do also have co-management committees. The involvement of claimants is significant in the IMP, in the local area plan, and of course in the annual action plan around BEFIS. We have a higher education access program which has to do with developing skills for the park for the future. So we have 77 young people in this program who are specifically looking at fields of education that are related to park management. And it's not just conservation tourism, it's engineering, it's finance, it's all sorts of skills that are needed to keep parks operating. We also have extensive capacity building programs for land claims trusts. My colleague mentioned earlier the challenge around capacity. So we run a program during the course of the year and look at different modules that have to do with governance, development, and so on. The terrain we work is quite complex. We work with 14 land claims trusts, 12 traditional authorities, 5 municipalities, and 2 district municipalities. And that's not to mention the CTO, the community tourism associations, and so on and so forth. So there's a big investment is needed just in capacity and development. I've mentioned the board representation, the co-management agreements, and the delivery on the higher education access program. I entitled this slide challenges, but perhaps it should be called opportunities, because this is where the creative energy goes to find solutions for the issues that face us. The RLCC's work is not entirely complete in the settlement of the agreements, and that often creates a bit of a backlash for your protected area managers, because government for people has one face. It doesn't matter what the department is, we're all one big body. Money hasn't been paid to a lot of the tenants under the agreement that have been settled, title hasn't transferred. One of the more critical issues, though, in the settlement model is that the value of the payment that goes to claimant doesn't take into account the economic potential of the land, which creates a huge challenge for the protected area manager. So you have the Mbila Trust, whose land is wilderness, and it has, by its nature and donation, limited development potential. So you would get one tourism development there, whereas, for example, in Fawana Bay, you can get 2,000 beds, and that's your Mabata Land Claims Trust. So we're constantly having to balance and juggle and see how we can optimize the benefit package taking into account the particular circumstances of each land claims trust. DLR has put together a fund to be able to assist and support post-settlement, but it's not quite operational and the terms of it are not clear. And finally, I've spoken a bit to the capacity building issue. The trusts are all voluntary organizations, so people come and go. There isn't a proper structure, your accountability is sometimes an issue, and youth representation is low. So a lot of your trusts at the moment are sitting with much older people who are going to, the continuity becomes a challenge. So we as an authority have to continue to engage and continue to invest in our partners so that we can deliver on our promise. And finally, there's a big contestation at the moment where Dr. DLR is trying to change trusts into community property associations, which had a set of challenges around decision-making and quorums and all sorts of things within the claim system. And you have two sets of land tenure, because you have the Ivanyan Trust, where there's no title, and then you have tenants who have title. So there are all sorts of dynamics within communities outside the park that one wrestles with to keep things sort of ticking over and working. And that's it.
Thank you very much. Then we have a body break for 5 minutes and then we come back.
Thank you.
Okay, are we ready? Now let us shout. Okay, I think it's time now to engage with the presentation. We must thank you very much for the presentation. And the members, I see they're ready to engage. Let's take hands. Honorable Kekane. Honorable Nandi and Honorable Makumea.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Honorable Members. Firstly, Chair, I want to say to all the representation, I'd like to highlight one presentation. In the picture shows the happiness of the I want to highlight that picture of happiness of reparation and developing of Kalahari. I like that picture. Thank you.
I was just looking at the hairstyle, and I remember there is a raging controversy now of Sura Jyothai about the hairstyles. So if they were to go to the Sura Jyothai, they won't be allowed to attend.
Thank you, Chair. What I
My question is that what are those aspects of capacity that you look for before you consider donating animals to the community? Thank you, Teacher.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. I just want first to appreciate the good work that has been done by the officials for SANPARKS and also Isimangaliso. And also appreciate one thing the most, the issue of community involvement in terms of getting the resources from the parks. There are a number of issues that have been raised. The first thing was the issue of on slide number 14, seeing those projects in terms of gardens. I just want to know whether do those people have market or the department is assisting them in terms of getting market, because in most cases you will find them having problems in terms of transport or whatever. Also, the second one is the issue of buzzers that are given to learners in the first presentation. I want to know whether these learners are going to be catered in terms of future employment in the parks. And the third one is that what is SANPARKS' long-term view of community involvement in wildlife management? Where do we see community involvement in, say, 10 to 20 years or 50 years to come? Is this in our plan? Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Edward.
Thank you, Chair. I'll start with brief. CEO, SANPARKS, I can't remember the detail, but I actually wanted to ask you something more specific about it, but please forgive me. A while ago, there was a lot in the media about the fences and the animals that got out, especially at the Refuge National Park. If you can just give us a little bit more information around that. I know you guys were on it fairly quickly, but I thought if you could just maybe give the community a little bit of before and after, something like that. As you know, you can read a lot in the media, and it's not necessarily, yeah, anyway. As you know, I'm a very big fan, person of SANPARKS and everything, etc. So after that presentation, I think Alicardi would be the next step. One of the very few that I haven't been to, because so far. And then specifically to donating with regards to animals. I know with very other organizations, especially when it comes to livestock, etc., what is your specific process, if I can call it that? Do you physically go do inspections first, background, what is it? Just basic, but like, but, you know, how do you, and then also, are there many applications for these animals? And like, let's say, for example, you donate animals from the cougar. Would you rather try and donate some of them before you do culling? Or what is your process there as well? I don't want to try and sound fluffy. It's just for interest sake. And then, specifically, I know it must be boring for you to get these type of questions, I know a while back the elephants were giving you a bit of trouble, specifically to the cougar. So, let's say you call the elephants, what do you do with their tusks? What happens with their tusks specifically? I know, you know, poaching, etc., etc. So, oh, and then one last thing that I forgot. The animals that you do donate, how do you decide which animals? All sorts of animals, will you donate a giraffe or an elephant, or just do like zebra and kudu and those kind of things? Thank you.
Thank you. Honorable Jambi, follow up.
In such a person, there's almost two things that I left behind. In both presentations, in terms of challenges, the one item that they talk about is these communities neglect management capacities. What are the plans of the department in order to assist the communities to develop the capacity in order to manage what they deserve to get in the past. Also, in the last presentation, in terms of challenges, There are 4 bullets that are left behind. You don't know whether it's a mistake or what. You can be understand on that one.
4 bullets or what?
Yes, Mangalisho that are left behind. They are not in the presentation, but we have seen them there.
Yeah, on the challenges, yeah, life flex on the challenges. the one that members have has got only 3 bullet points, and the other one has got more. So I think you work on the last slide after you have submitted the information here to Parliament. Yeah, those are the questions. Can I just find out from I see the models are different in Isimangaliso. There is a representation of those communities who are land claimants. In what form are they represented? They're just ordinary members of the board, or is there a special role that they play in the board, taking into consideration that the appointment of other members of the board follows a different process? I just want to get the structure of the board. How is the board constituted? Yeah. But otherwise, I think that they present some presentations are straightforward. I'm interested in this donation one. Just to add on that, which animals that donated, well, you have indicated how many have already donated to the communities. But this donation is a vehicle, which is the best model. Instead of culling the animals, then to donate almost, or whether there are some issues around the kind of animals that you need to kill. You can just speak to that. Over to you. Oh, you come out to culling. Honorable Mokwen, I thought you were solid. Okay.
So, I really get so that. At the time, so, just a few. In these models, both of you, as you may respond to that, we have seen in other activities, economic activities, where there was this element of fronting. To what extent don't we have fronting tendencies in your area? Or are able to get on those things that, and the opportunity of these SMMEs to grow because they may not, they are not natural. So at some point they must grow and develop and get out of being SMEs, and that needs projection so that we don't just get the good that. Chair, I'm interested as well in the having followed by some parts, the use of this class, the other uses and from that we are engaging. Just to say, what is the profile of the persons or people who have access to some of these uses in the class? If you get what I'm saying, at times if we're saying we're allowing some of the things or whatever else in the park, do we see fair access to that by all communities or persons who have got an interest, or others are not even aware that you do this thing, and then it's historically those who have been benefiting who are able to get to that. And I think there's one also issue we need to know. In these models, all of them are varied. Are you sure that these communities are not somewhat exploited? in your model, then we safely say here that our communities get meaningful shares in this work life, or to what extended work can particularly standardize some of these models. I know it may not always be easy, but instead of having another module for that community, another module for that community, and so why don't we standardize all those? That's the last question. The community, the local community, can be an issue for tensions. Who is the local community? Well, they may not easily define the terms. What is the radius? To what extent can you go and say, you are still local? You know, both of you. It's Mangali, so we refer to a claimant, but it's like you can go beyond claimant. But how do you leave other communities? When you say Ajavan to Kruger, if we're talking Kruger or talking Ismail, how adjacent to project can I be left behind and say, you know, when we do demarcation of disparities, some people are cut out and they say, no, we also want to belong to the other side. And it has to be difficult to say who belongs and who doesn't. I'm just saying, if I were to bring that, to borrow that to the situation, it may be that Kruger wants to cut or another part of your national park wants to cut some community out. How do you do that safely without that creating a problem? Chair, the Sun Parks has incorporated some areas into the national parks, like Kisikama and so on, which used to be part of the community forestry agreement, meaning that communities may no longer be able to manage those areas. Now, what does it mean? Does it mean that as communities may now, if they have capacity, be able to apply for managing some of these parts? And in Mangalis, when you said the land that is claimed is not calculated, the value is not calculated in terms of, if you say, economical potential. Perhaps both of you, may you indicate how do you calculate the value of the land that we pay to claimants? I think that may assist us to understand what becomes this value of this land that we're dealing with. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much. Can we start with Sun Parks?
Sorry, sir. Can I just one slide?
Just one slide. Yes.
The cabinet decision 2008 that we may no longer, I think you know you talked about that. The communities insist that they still want to claim their land, because we're saying there must be an alternative way of redress, but there have been precedents in that regard. Now, is there a legal basis other than, or that decision becomes a legal basis? Is there a legal basis that you can say, no, we can't give him the other than just to say there's a cabinet decision and countries are insisting that they need to get
How I understand is that if they are claiming land which is in the Kruger National Park, the only model, according to the cabinet, is financial compensation. They can't restore the land, extra land, or do anything else. But I think you'll elaborate. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson, honorable members. My colleagues will also chip in. Honorable Kekana, only one on the aspects of capacity we're looking. It's always easy to work with organized structures in a community. That's number one. Number two, you want strong leadership
you also want to work with those partners who will understand the benefits. Because I think you need to demonstrate that it's a good thing to do. They must be convinced 100% that we want to enter in the business of government of managing national parks. Therefore, what is key in any structure? Good leadership and cohesion amongst the stakeholders. To me, it's always a winner. Once you get that, things you interface better with communities. Because the challenge we have now is change of leadership. You go and talk to this structure, there's a chairperson with a committee. You go back to the new committee. Now you start fresh in terms of engaging. Consistency is always key. What we've seen working is in Archipelago. After 10 years after I left Sandbox, coming back, I saw the same people. There was a stability there in terms of leadership. You feel that you can keep people there who can hand over to the future leadership. One is stability. Honorable Nyambi, the one for gardens, my colleague will come in later in the market. When it comes to bursaries, it is always our wish that when there's a national park that is under claim, one will feel that the tourism manager should be coming from the local community. The park manager is an idea to come from the community. Those who do technical services and maintenance, even scientists, one wishes that he should be coming from the local community. This is the type of bursaries I give them, to start tourism, to start conservation, to even start engineering. I know Isimanga Liz has done well on this area, perhaps she can elaborate further, because this thing of bursaries, I saw speed Isimanga Liz saw, but in Sandbox we're also doing it. But the criteria is to the people will be relevant to come and manage a national park moving forward. There are different aspects in any national park management. The issue of what future do we want? The whole issue that we call land use compatibility, that's what we want. We want a situation whereby neighbors say, we like your business, we like your land use, therefore want to join. It makes things easier. Because once you start different land uses that are dynamic, you are immediately get conflict, like the ease of fences. Because animals get out, a leopard, it will eat a goat or a sheep. Now you must develop a compensation scheme. But if that community can say, we are never in Kruger, we see the number of tourists and the potential, therefore we are willing to change our land into conservation. But I must say, you do have cultural differences and traditional ways of looking at things. Because if you have more cattle in the village, at a meeting they listen to you. Because the sign of richness that we are rich, we have cattle. Therefore, you cannot say I have kudus and buffalo, because what is that? Therefore, there's that element of cultural differences. But it's always good that people must see what is working. Because this thing of what I call cost-benefit analysis. If you have been investing in livestock, each time there's drought, they die your livestock. You start saying, this I must change my approach. Although I like my cattle, but it's not working because it's getting drier, there's no water. Therefore, people should look at the returns on the investment. Honorable Edwards, the issue of animals getting out of the park, it is still happening, especially when people break a fence. For whatever reason, there will be animals getting out, and then they do damage to crop and livestock. It's the thing that we are managing. We worked with the Department of Agriculture, I'm talking about the western boundary of Kruger, because of disease control and also issues of what we call human wildlife conflict. It's ongoing. As a result, we have introduced some compensation scheme, which is so difficult to manage because you must inspect the damage, make sure indeed the animal is coming from Kruger. When it comes, animal might come from anywhere. Therefore, there's that sensitivity in managing the compensation scheme when people have lost livestock. You are welcome to this Harahadi. It's nice and hot now. Very hot. Donations, as I indicated earlier, Patrick, you look at what you call land suitability and viability. Of course, we do inspections because we don't want to introduce an animal that does not belong there. There's an issue about species that they call extralimiters. Species occurred in one part of the country. Why not in another part of the country? Then we need to look at those samples before we look at the donation. When you say habitat suitability and viability, your fences must be also right. You can have a good vegetation, but if your fences are not right, those animals will be stolen or they will be killed once they get out of that area. We would like to look at donating before culling, but it's an idea for us because we are starting creating corridors, establishing new populations. But issue of land availability is key. You can only do even by saying, I'm ready, I have my land, my fences are intact, I have the lodge here, I can start hunting immediately, or I can start an ecotourism activity. But the problem, people don't have land as yet. Even the emerging game farmers, they are starting now to look for land themselves, but they can afford to buy the land. But that nurturing and guiding is very, very important because most people are used to livestock management. Elephant culling, we're not yet looking at that, but the day we want to start doing so, we inform Parliament because it becomes very controversial, very polarized. In terms of keeping the ivory, we have a vault in Kruger that we are keeping. Those from your natural motives because we took all of those. Animals we donate. After we made the call, we were flooded with many requests. I established a committee to adjudicate those led by Paul and most of the executives. Those must look at each application individually, do a follow-up, and then we do a final approach because it must be managed tightly. Otherwise, it might end up being a free-for-all. But what with people are looking for what we call high-value species. They will ask for a nyala. I think it's a beautiful animal. They ask for roan. They will ask for sable. They ask for buffaloes. Suddenly, people have been learning the terms because these animals are selling well. Even in our case, those animals are few in our own national parks, these high value species. But when we picked up, people are looking for high value species because of this breeding trend. But we would like to encourage people, start with small animals first. Your impala, your kudu, which is not risky to manage because it's not expensive. Once you see yourself now, knowing how to maintain fences, control fences, supply water, you can start looking at high value species.
Paul, let me just interrupt a bit. Talking about high value species that gets donated, I was following up on a story about the Northwest Parks and Tourism Board when such kind of animals were donated. Your rhino, you know, your high value species. I know that it may not be something that you are in charge of, but I would like you just to comment on that because I'm playing with the idea whether should we look into that given this, it has been widely covered, I'm sure you are aware of that, or whether it's something that we can ask our colleagues in the province to give us a report on that.
I was reluctant to try this one. Chair, I can be frank and open. Because for me, there shouldn't have been a process. This is why even SEMPAS established this committee to adjudicate, so that we can be able to defend our decisions. Therefore, the notice one worried me a bit when I read in the newspapers, because the government is starting to do a drive of the life economy. And there was a lab now, a partial lab, a wireless economy, just to see how government can fast track this. But the ones in Northwest, that would be nice if the panel can ask them. It worried us. He used to be the CEO of Northwest Parks Hall. Perhaps he can comment on that one.
I would really love to get our preliminary views on this one, so that, you know, coming from where we are, we can understand the issue better, because I did not really understand why you can donate such kind of animals and lose numbers. So, but maybe Paul can just say something. I'm soliciting views because I've not raised it to the committee, but I think the matter that disturbed me a bit, and I would like it to be followed up.
Chair, I do think it's an issue which has raised false expectations as to what government can do in terms of supporting new entrants to the wildlife economy. And the approach taken in the Northwest, where a large value of animals, I think, was in excess of 80 million rand, was donated to three individuals, if I'm correct in reports, is one which we don't follow. And when we look at our wildlife economy support program, we differentiate communities from individuals. When communities apply to us, and sometimes we are proactive, we go out and identify communities. And these are communities we have a long-term relationship with. It's not a new relationship. There are communities we've been working with, recruiting people for the Expanded Public Works Program, offering environmental education programs. So we have a long-term relationship with the communities. And jointly with the communities, we identify that potential. We then ask the communities to apply to us and put requests to us. And as the CE says, we evaluate that against a set criteria. We make a number of visits to the property where we bring our wildlife specialists, but we also bring our community development specialists who are able to assess all the institutions ready within that community. Is there functioning CPAs, their functioning trust, or do we have to provide support in terms of institutional development before we can actually donate animals into that? So the community process is different to the process with individuals, where we haven't yet donated any animals to individuals, and we are approaching it quite carefully. Although we've had a number of engagements, we are receiving many requests from individuals, and we want to identify a process which gives opportunity, almost like a tender. You put an advert in the paper saying SEMPAS is offering certain levels of support. If you are interested, please apply on the prescribed form. And we don't want to engage with individuals who are super rich. And we don't want to engage with individuals who have nothing. They have no land, they have no capacity, nothing at all. We are looking in between. And then with those individuals, once we've put it through a fairly rigorous process, somewhat similar to a tender process, we will identify a number of individuals. If we will go into a loan agreement, a custodianship agreement, where we might loan them a herd of high-value species, buffalo, for instance. And then we would expect we would retain ownership of the base herd, and the progeny would be theirs, and then after a certain time, the base herd, we would then donate to somebody else. We would be able to maximize our support through that sort of mechanism. So I'm afraid the way it was done in the Northwest did create difficulties for government as a whole, because government is just embarking on a wildlife economy program which aims to transform and grow the wildlife economy by bringing in communities, bringing in emerging game ranches. And we wouldn't be able to afford as government, I don't believe, to go the route the Northwestern is donating a high value of species, which was probably a large proportion of the surplus in parks like Pilanesberg and Madikwe, to three individuals. So we would believe that there must be a proper process, there must be a proper assessment of how far one can go to support individuals. We are actually actively looking for communities, however. There are not many communities in the land who have the capacity, who are suitable in terms of environment. So we are more proactive with communities. We actually go out and look for communities to work with. But without knowing the detail of how the decision was made in the Northwest, from where we sit in our wildlife economy program, it seems to be an appropriate intervention.
Okay, thank you very much. There's something that requires follow-up, I'm sure we'll do. Other questions?
One of Maguela, the funding one is a dangerous one. We are watching it. Hence, before we donate, we want to make sure that indeed we have the land. But there's always a risk there. We even watch funding on the hive of species because to take a rhino is a liability. You must have capacity to manage a rhino. Therefore, those are requested for rhinos and buffaloes say, I will be able to handle them because you don't want to go back to your farm. The animals are not there. They are in another property. Therefore, we are watching that one. The issue of abuses, Elizabeth can be confined to people utilize that for those other services. Yes, or no, the issue of varying the models, or varying models, it prevails, but we would like to standardize. Because we are learning as we move along, but hence we are developing policies, criteria, and guidelines in order to be able to standardize. We are still differentiating between claimant community and the neighbor. Because a claimant community, once you see your land, you are like, you become like a shareholder of Sandbox. Therefore, an engagement should be slightly different compared to a person who is just a neighbor. Therefore, we're trying to couple with these issues. Hence, we have a model that we are taking to the board in order to deal with claimant communities. Who is a neighbor? And the radius around the park. We still need to define these honorable members. But for now, we are dealing with neighbors whose administrative land are part of the park. If your land, we have neighbors, even your physical location, let's say a village that will be 40 kilometers from the park boundary. But if that land comes all the way to the park, it's neighbor. Therefore, we're using that criteria for now. But we would like to define it legally. Because people must say, you are leaving me out. If I'm 100 kilometers away, am I not your neighbor? I think we need a clear cut criteria. For now, we look at administrative boundary. Once we set the boundary with you, automatically we must work. Because if we don't do, there will be some conflict. Paul will do the forestry. Lina, you must quickly talk to the cabinet decision. But in terms of the Restitution Act, there are three officers there that she will talk to. Cabinet,
let's take all of them, so because we don't have time now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so you can quickly just deal with all of them.
Okay. For the children that don't have information, Paul, take that one quickly in the cabinet.
So very quickly, it is correct that we have incorporated both indigenous forests as well as mountain catchment areas in the guard route. And that we had to take over from the then Department of Agriculture and Forestry staff who were on different conditions of service, but also certain community programs which were run differently to how Sandbox was doing. To my knowledge, we haven't stopped any of those programs. We actually proceeded with those programs, but put them within the Sandbox context. We have a very large community outreach program in the garden. Gondrup, the one area where we were not able to succeed was the harvesting of trees in the indigenous forest, where the Department of Forestry had been doing it themselves. It was being done at a great loss. When we took it over, ultimately outsourced it. The outsourced company could not make it because of the way that harvesting of indigenous trees is done. It's not like going into a plantation. So that is one aspect where we didn't continue with one of the projects, one of the outreach programs that was being done by the Department of Forestry.
And responding on the vegetables quickly, in terms of the access to the market, yes, we do facilitate that. We have what we call the PSC officers that are officials on the ground that are working with the communities, assisting them to grow as enterprises. So we facilitate access to the market as well, and would like as far as possible for us as AMPAX to be the first call in terms of it happening in other parts already where they are already supporting or supplying vegetables to us. And with regard to the profile of communities or persons which have access, we have what we call the, I think the PE has already alluded to the who the local communities are. And in terms of the access, most of the people that are provided access to the resources are from the local communities. They are community funds that our PNC users are working with. So it's more a structured way of identifying who those people are in terms of engaging with the communities for them to then have access to the resources that we have. Thank you.
In terms of the reality of the cabinet decision, it was based, when you look at the Restitution Act, it says that restitution is either you get restoration of the right in land or equitable redress, and cabinet made that decision of equitable redress. But also the Restitution Act allows that there be no restoration if it's in a matter of a national interest. So our argument to cabinet was that not giving back Kruger to the claimants would be in a matter of national interest.
Thank you very much, Shangalis.
But if I briefly touch on the bursary issue, what we do is we offer workplace experience during holidays and then internships. There's never a guarantee, though, that you're going to be able to retain the young people who come through this. One of the big challenges with bursaries is feeder schools. So you'll have one group of claimants saying, well, we don't have the same the same number of bursaries as another claimant group. So what we're doing now is maybe dabbling a little bit in the Department of Education's business, but looking at the schools and looking at ways to improve the math and science results so that you can get more children into university and qualifying for bursaries, especially in the less successful areas. The appointment of the board, there are 13 categories that the minister can appoint people from. With claimants and with traditional councils, basically two people are nominated. So the claimants will nominate two people for the minister, and traditional leadership will nominate two people. Those are considered by the minister, and she will recommend an appointment through the normal cabinet process. As part of the board, and they have the same voting rights as every other board member. Looking at the fronting issue, I can't say that we have 100% success in managing this, but we are very rigorous. Before we award anything, we look at the shareholder agreements, we look at the financing arrangements, all of the issues around that to satisfy ourselves that this isn't a pretend game. We then put provisions in our contract to make sure that the ownership arrangements don't change without permission and so on and so forth, and then there's a monitoring process. Where, like for example in our PPPs, where your community shareholders is a minority shareholder, we also then insist on minority protection in the shareholders agreement. So there are certain classes of divisions that can only be made if your community board representative is part and parcel of the decision. And for the activity concessions, which are much smaller, and also obviously have the potential for fronting, all of the community-owned activities have a place on our enterprise program. So we are actively monitoring that business and making sure that it is being run, in fact, by the person who should be running it. And looking at SMEs and how they grow, yes, a lot of the infants are survivalist. And so we know that a certain proportion will stay that way. But where we see the growth, what we're looking at is creating two streams. So you have a stream for the ones that are able to make it into bigger enterprise and bigger companies, so you can put a different type of attention and a different sort of investment in terms of skill development in that group. While you're keeping your smaller ones who are not going to ever be the big employers also taking over and operational. How we define local community, basically we look at anybody who's in the Umkhonyakude and Kwambalambi district municipality areas. And then in terms of our contracts and our agreements, we tier them. So we say it's got to be a claimant, preference is claimants, then people more broadly in the traditional, that fall within the traditional council area. And we do require documentation from Land Claims Trust and traditional council to say people are residents in the area. Because that's who we really want to benefit. We want to benefit the people along the boundary of our park. It doesn't, I'm not saying it's not a good thing to benefit somebody who's living in Joburg, but the real need is right there and then. Those are the people who don't have the opportunities. And then looking at the value of land, I think the best example maybe is to compare the Pinda settlement, where there's a willing buyer, willing seller, and you have a market. And so the settlement that Pinda got to Conservation Corporation at the time was in excess of 70 million. It comes nowhere near what the RLCC is paying for settlements on government land, because they're not using the willing buyer, willing seller principle to assess the value of the property and so on. We look at economic potential in terms of the number of facilities we can build and number of activities we can operate, because those are the things that are going to generate the revenue for the claimants. And we know in terms of our IMP and our parks donation that in your higher density nodes, the potential is much higher than in your wilderness nodes where there isn't anything. And so we feel the RLCC should be taking that into consideration, instead of making a flat payment of 10,000 rand a household to everybody, irrespective of the long-term potential that can be generated. But I think that was everything. I'm not sure if I've missed anything.
Let's thank you very much for coming. We needed to have a sense of the role that the national parks are playing in the communities where they are located. I think that is what we wanted to get from this briefing, and I think it's clear now. Some of this information you begin to internalize, and at the next opportunity we're able then to ask questions given what the information that we have received. But I think up to so far we're happy with the role that the national parks are playing, especially to the communities where you are located. Because quite often communities complain to say, we've got a national asset next to us, but we are not benefiting in any way whatsoever. But I like the concept of a wildlife economy, where the communities, not only the communities, but also the emerging entrepreneurs can be able to participate in that kind of of an economy. So we've got an oceans economy, we've got a wildlife economy. So one gets to grapple with all these concepts as we move along. Thank you very much for coming. I think we are ready to adjourn the meeting. We were supposed to go to Smangalisi. We were supposed to visit on the 19th. It doesn't look like we're going to come, because there's people and parts conference where we are told we'll also be participating, and the communities and some of the stakeholders that we're going to engage with will also be forming part of that. So I must say that it's a bit unfortunate that I won't be able to go there because of this. We are looking at, we're still talking to the department to see whether